Hello and welcome to In Focus with Insight. My name is Pamela Hillig. I'm head of Insight Life Solutions, and this is an episode of the Open Books series in which we get to know inspiring and fascinating people in the actuarial and insurance community through the books that they have read and loved. Today I'm joined by Melissa Ramsamy Agapetus. Melissa is a seasoned actuary and a leader with 20 years' experience across the life insurance, pension fund, investment, and healthcare sectors. She has worked for Jacques Milan Consultants and Actuaries, Alex Forbes, Old Mutual, and is currently at Liberty Corporate Benefits, where she serves as the executive for group risk and investment. She is a passionate leader and has a wealth of knowledge, insights, and experience in leading large teams across South Africa and Africa. Melissa is married to Ipinge and is mum to Luke, who is 12 years old, and Annabelle, who is 10. In her spare time, she enjoys watching the kids play their respective sports or keeping fit herself by training at the gym or on the road.
Welcome to the podcast, Mel.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Tell me, are you a reader?
Yes. I used to be a very big reader when I was younger, but I think now with mom commitments and work commitments, time is quite limited. So I try.
Okay, well, that still counts as a reader, though. And that's a good thing because this is a podcast unlike any other in which we will get to know you better and hear about the things keeping you busy, but with the added angle of the books that have shaped you in some way. So we think of it as the Desert Island Discs for bibliophiles.
Mm.
But before we get into the books, tell me, what is on your mind? What's keeping you busy at the moment?
There's so much going on. My husband is training for Comrades. My son is starting to write exams. So between Liberty, which is my number one priority most of the time, but mom priorities take over at times, between Liberty and the family, there's not much time for anything else. So I have to actually prioritize going to the gym and keeping fit to keep that sanity piece going as well.
So what are some things you're busy with at work? At the moment.
At work, we are keeping a keen eye on what's happening in the group risk space. How is mortality rates going? Because you know, during COVID, we had significantly bad mortality experience because of all the lives lost. And then post-COVID, we've had a little bit of a tailwind in terms of lower mortality experience. Now we're seeing it starting to normalize a bit. So we're watching and seeing how that grows at the moment. We are developing some new products on the investment side. We're doing some changes on the umbrella side as well for Liberty Corporate Benefits. So lots of things keeping me busy.
Oh, yeah. It sounds so exciting. And, it's been a while since I've actually heard what the latest thinking is on building loadings for COVID into mortality rates. So it'd be interesting to get your views on that in a bit. I'm keen to get into the books. And to just warm up, I want to know a bit about your reading habits. So maybe to start with, what genres do you enjoy reading?
If I had all the time in the world and all the time was mine, I would love to continue reading. I like crime. I like fantasy. So it depends on my mood. So mostly fiction type books where I can escape. And I think as a young reader, well, I didn't know it then, but I know it now, I get overstimulated very quickly. So reading was a source of escape for me to calm, to escape somewhere else, to be able to calm my mind. At the moment, though, I don't have a lot of time for fiction books. I have been reading quite a lot of nonfiction books.
Okay. I was wondering about, that selection. So do you find you read for work or to kind of improve your leadership skills, your management and so on for work purposes?
Yeah. And also just to become a more well-rounded human being and individual rather than for work. But mostly it is to self-improvement.
If you were to write a book, what genre do you think you would play in?
Yeah, I was thinking about that as well. I think like a horror comedy. Because I do like scary movies, but not too scary. Okay. So when I'm like, yes, I think I would be quite good with a horror comedy.
Maybe it could be, actually, I feel like there is almost a horror series about an actuary or a serial killer, I think. I feel like I'm making this up, but if I am, then maybe that's your in for when you start writing. Okay, so let's get into the books. What's the first one we got into the box?
So the first one that I brought today is Dear Jalid. It's by Brené Brown. It's quite a popular one, which I'm sure you're aware of as well. And you wanted me to read a quote.
And that, yes, yeah, let's start with the quote and then we can talk about what it's about.
I think Brené has so many beautiful ideas and there's so many gems in her book. If you look at this book, there's so many pages that I fold top and bottom.
Okay, so you start to fold. Do you highlight? Do you make notes?
I don't highlight. I feel like that's vandalism.
Okay, sorry, but folding.
Folding is also vandalism.
You know that, we all have our own rules.
Yes. Okay. So she says, clear is kind. Unclear is unkind. So what does that mean? Oh, can I swear on your show? No.
Yes. Oh, well, please. Yeah, that's fine. If Brené said it, you know, who are we to judge?
Yeah. So it says, feeding people half-truths or bullshit to make them feel better, which is almost always about making ourselves feel more comfortable, is unkind. Not getting clear with a colleague about your expectations because it feels too hard, yet holding them accountable or blaming them for not delivering is unkind. Talking about people rather than to them is unkind. This lesson has so wildly transformed my life that we live by it at home.
I feel like that's one of the most difficult things. For me, I found a challenge is giving critical feedback without making it about the person.
Yeah.
How do you apply this in work?
So I've also struggled with giving people feedback historically or in the past because, like she says, it's about me. And I want to be comfortable and I don't want to make you uncomfortable by telling you something that's going to make us both uncomfortable. But you can be honest with someone without being unkind or without being unprofessional. So what I've done is I'm sticking to the facts and to say at the beginning of the task, what is clear? What does good look like at the end? So I would clear up front. And then if the person delivers in a way that is not what we agreed, then it's an easy conversation to say, we agreed this outcome, but the outcome is not where it needed to be. Or if it's a colleague that you've not agreed the outcome with upfront, I think the biggest lesson that I've learned is to play the ball, not the man. So what is the item that we are not satisfied with? It's not about Pam. Whoever could be there would have been doing it like that. So what is the item that we are not happy with and how do we correct it going forward? I'd rather, even if it's me that has not delivered, can you tell me what you're unhappy with rather than telling somebody else? So I'd rather say, Pam, these are the things that we agreed on, but it's not delivered rather than complaining to John about Pam.
Okay, so have you found that, has that kind of culture of fair, honest, kind feedback permeated throughout your team? Do you find that by you being comfortable doing that, the rest of your team is also?
I think we are all individuals at the end of the day. And sometimes some deliveries are not as one would hope that it is, even if the person is trying and it's coming from a place of kindness. But we all have development areas and that's what we are trying to work on. We're trying to work on, let's play the ball and not the man.
Okay. So would you say, you know, employing that kind of philosophy, has it strengthened your relationships with your colleagues?
I think so. And I think I often say to my colleagues and the guys in my team, if I'm upset with you, you're going to hear from me that I'm upset with you or not satisfied with the level of work that's done. You're not going to hear it from somebody else. You'll know.
Yeah, and you need that trust. And also, hopefully, they'll know before performance appraisal time, you know. Yeah, which I think everyone appreciates from their managers. So that's one of the ideas from Dare to Lead. What else is this book about?
This book is just about how can you be vulnerable and still be a good leader? And what are the traits that you need to be a brave leader? Embracing shame, embracing failures. It's almost a manual that I keep going back to remind myself of. You need to be kind to yourself and then you can be kind to others. You need to be brave and acknowledge what you feel are your own insecurities and own them. And then you can be a better leader, knowing yourself and knowing what you are capable of and your values.
What does it mean to own your insecurities? Because I'm trying to think, you know, I love this idea of, you know, vulnerability and all that, but you know, how does it look in real life?
So I think owning your insecurities, being vulnerable, all those ideas help the people that you are working with to realize that you are also a human being. Because sometimes what they see of you as a leader or as a manager of their manager is just this persona that they see on a podcast or on the stage, or they don't know that you have had failures. You also struggle with things. You also struggle with imposter syndrome, etc. So me being able to say, these are the things that I struggle with, but it doesn't make me an inferior person. In fact, it makes me stronger knowing what I struggle with. I think it's a good modeling behavior for the younger people that are also working with us.
So just, yeah, I guess talking about it, being open about it.
Yes.
Yeah, calling in people where you know that you have weaknesses, that they can kind of compensate for that because they're better at things that you aren't. So,
yes, yeah. And being comfortable when there are smarter people than you in the room. But Brené also says to be careful not to be too vulnerable with your audience as well. I mean, there are boundaries that one would need to set. You shouldn't be oversharing with your colleagues either. So finding that balance is interesting also.
And I know you've said you're passionate about growing the actuarial industry, and specifically in terms of, you know, diversity and inclusion. Do you think, and I don't know if it's just because it's a female author, but this strikes me as kind of a female intuitive way of leading, you know, leading with vulnerability and openness. Do you think employing those kind of techniques and cultures within our teams can help with, you know, making minorities or, you know, traditionally less representative parts of the population feel comfortable to become leaders in that rural community?
Yeah, well, men can also be vulnerable, as yeah. I've found. But what this type of leadership does is it invites people to come to work as their whole selves. You don't have to hide a piece of yourself because you feel like you won't fit in or people won't understand. Bring your whole self. I often say to the guys at Liberty Corporate as well, is that I don't care what your sexual orientation is, what your beliefs are, come to work as your whole self and let's see what your whole self is. You shouldn't be making yourself small to fit in, because the world has changed so much now. So you need to take up space and be yourself, because there's only one of you in the world.
I guess that extends to also accepting who you are professionally and which things you're good at, and not try to be someone else or be good at the things that other people are. I guess something I've thought about a lot, that authenticity of valuing yourself and the things that you can bring to the table.
Yes, absolutely. And I think a comparison is the thief of joy. I'm often saying that as well a lot. It's so easy. And some of the quotes that I have in some of the other books as well. It's so easy to get stuck in comparing. Oh, but Pam has X, Y, and Z, a better car, a better house, a better husband.
High salary.
Yes. What are the things that, let's take a step back and say, what are we grateful for? I'm grateful for my job, my house, my kids, my education, my quality of life. But your today and your normal is something that someone else is dreaming of. But we are not thankful for what we have, I think, because they've got a quote, I think, in The Subtle Art of everything is so available now. So you can see what's on social media.
Mm-hmm. But
what's on social media is all the happy pictures. There's like 100 pictures that of yuckiness that has led to the one perfect picture that the person that you are jealous of is posting. You only put the happy things on social media.
So of all the kind of leadership books you could have brought today, why do you think this is the one that stands out?
This one is about, and I like Brené because she talks about wholehearted living, about rumbling with vulnerability, about being your full authentic self. And that is something that I struggled with coming into our profession. Because when I qualified in 2011, how many years ago was that? Like 14. I was one of very few women and people of color that had qualified then. And even in a boardroom, you would be a one of very few brown women that's in the boardroom. So I would make myself small to fit in. And Brené has taught me, but I am beautiful as an individual, and I have many thoughts that I can share with the boardroom. So why make myself small? And I guess that comes with experience and age as well. But now that we have more, not enough, but more women and people of color in the profession, it is easier to see representation and it's easier to make people feel welcome and have that environment. So I think that's great.
And it's easier or maybe more permissible not to be perfect because, yes. You know, if there are more of you, then there isn't that pressure to kind of represent everyone and almost be the one that allows other people through the door by being perfect.
But I don't. So no one is perfect. They seem perfect, but they're not. I don't know if you've seen that Disney picture with all the princesses and they say the more you look at it, the worse it gets. I must find that picture for you.
Yeah, it sounds scary.
It is scary. So what's, when you're looking at it, I'm wasting time now. But when you're looking at it, it's, you know, it's Belle and it's Sleeping Beauty and whatever, and it looks really cool. But then when you look carefully, like there's an arm.
Yeah, the extra hand.
Yes.
The feet.
So nobody's life is perfect. And if you go and scrutinize, you're going to find faults. But we need to be happy in that imperfect. We are imperfect.
Yes. Great. Well, what's the next book we're going to talk about?
Okay. The next one is Magda. Do I say it Magda? I don't know. And I can't pronounce her surname.
We all know. We all know.
Do you know who I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Yes. Cool.
It's her, my journey, is that?
Yes.
Okay.
My journey. So this book was about her journey on her progress of moving from Poland.
I think so.
Studying actuarial science at UCT, being in the Jewish community, how she navigated her way, because she was also one of the earlier women to qualify as an actuary. You know, and finding past papers, things like that, where you don't know what to do, getting into that community and finding her way.
Was that in the 90s or when was it that she was qualifying?
Late 90s.
Okay, yeah. Yeah. And I don't know if she's the founder of Signia or she was.
I think she stepped away now, yes, but she is the founder. She says, I'm often asked by other women, can I have it all as a woman and achieve balance? And can I lead a fulfilling life? And she says, the answer to the first is a resounding no, but an emphatic yes to the second. And then she goes on to say about how simple a man's life is, because, you know, it's simple and it's linear. She says, traditionally, a man gets up in the morning expecting his breakfast to be made and his shirts to be ironed. Well, I don't know if that's the case now, but this is an example. He goes to work where he can focus without interruption. He doesn't have to worry about phone calls from school, unexpected medical appointments, or organizing a plumber. He comes home to a warm meal. He can relax in front of the TV, etc. A woman, however, is a juggler. She's expected to shop, maintain a clean home, organize, repair, supervise the children and their homework, attend school meetings, drive the children to parties, after-school activities, make time for exercise, look good, iron those shirts, cook those meals, and then possibly still have a career. So she says, as a woman, you cannot have it all and achieve balance. What you can do is choose your priorities. So what is important to you? Is it having a career or being a mother? And there are no wrong answers. Each option comes with its rewards and sacrifices. And once you have chosen, if you have a choice, of course, give up or outsource the activities that make you unhappy or take up too much time. And I found that very useful because I thought I was the only one struggling to find the balance and dealing with the guilt, I guess, of outsourcing things. So, for example, I want balance between my work and my kids, but I can't afford time to pick them up from school every day and take them to the extramurals, etc. So what was important for me was to be present for the children and to be a good worker. But that meant that I couldn't do all these things. But it was easy once I prioritized, because then I said, okay, so how can I outsource these things? And that was when we decided to get an au pair. So she picks them up from school, she helps them with their homework, etc. I can still have the cuddles in the evening and listen to the stories of the day and check the homework and make sure that everything is to my standard. But it saves me that time and the added stress.
So I guess, you know, being a fellow prominent female actuary, can you tell me about your background and your, you know, your journey both into the profession and then perhaps your leadership journey as well?
Hmm. I think a lot of your audience would probably have heard my story already, but I don't know if I can do it in 2 minutes, but I will try. So I grew up in Chatsworth. It's an Indian township south of Durban. My parents were both blue collar workers. My mom was a housewife for the most part, and she only went back to work when I went to high school. So she worked in a factory where they would make car seat covers.
Okay.
And my dad owned a taxi, a minibus taxi, owned and drove a taxi. And so growing up in the 80s and 90s, if you were smart or intelligent at school and coming from a brown household, there was a set number of professions that you were expected to pursue. It was a doctor, lawyer, or a teacher.
Okay.
Sorry. So for the most part of my schooling career, I was going to study medicine and that was it. But then in standard 9, which is grade 11, for our younger viewers, I think my dad, he had a cut on his hand and he said, "Oh, you're going to be a doctor. Can you please help me?" And I tell you, I saw the blood and I started to see spots, almost fainted. And I was like, "Oh my goodness, how am I going to do this medicine thing?" Didn't really have career advice either. I mean, it was a government school. We were running on fumes in terms of financial support, etc. So my mom said, "You know, I've heard of this thing." She heard about it when, like, some aunties were chatting at a funeral.
Good place to hear about.
It's called actuarial science, and it's for people who are good at maths. That's all she heard. And that's how I started actuarial science. I applied at UCT. I got in. I didn't qualify for any bursaries because I only had 5 A's out of 6 subjects that I was doing in matric. And I mean, I didn't know that everyone in the top 30 in South Africa at that time would also be studying actuarial science. I had no idea what it was. And maybe that was a good thing, because I think if I knew then what I know now, would I have gone with my eyes fully open? I was so naive. And
how hard can it be?
She said, for people that are good with maths. So, we were not in Kansas anymore then. It was difficult. It was a difficult journey. I would call my dad in tears and say, "I'm done. I'm done now. Can I please just come home?" But we struggled to pay the school fees as well, right? So my dad would say, "Okay, but I've paid for this semester. Can you please finish the semester and then come home?" And then I would complete the semester and then it wasn't so bad and then continue. And I went semester by semester with the degree and eventually finished the degree and then started working for Jacques Moulin. And by then I've started it. I need to finish it. And
you're too deep in now. Too late. Turn back.
Yes. Can I have a DNF? Yes.
When did you start enjoying? Did you start enjoying work from the beginning, or was there a point where things got better?
Yeah. So work, I've always enjoyed. I have not enjoyed the exams.
Oof.
Can I say? And your audience is going to throw eggs at me, but you can't because I'm going to spit. The exams are not difficult. It's the anxiety leading up to the exams and everything that's weighing on it. And the whole world knows you're writing exams.
They know when results are coming out.
Yes.
They know what you
Those person. Days, you couldn't hide your name.
If I married you do that now.
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, you can say you don't want your name to be published. But the whole world is watching now.
Where are you working in an actuarial, a big actuarial employer?
Yes. Yeah. And all the failure is part of the journey. Failure is part of the journey. That is the humbling experience. Everyone that you know that has studied actuarial science has failed something along the way. And if they haven't, there's something wrong. That's the serial killer book that I'm going to write. But it was, I think the exams was not hard. It's the journey enjoying work, I didn't know any better either. So doing the grunt work of cleaning the data for evaluation, I like numbers. I like it when things add up. So I didn't mind that. I actually miss doing the number crunching pieces now, because now I'm just oversight and giving advice. But as it evolves, I think it becomes more and more enjoyable. I think my career has been like a nice wine that is maturing. No. Aging
well. And I guess it's, like you were saying earlier, as you gain life experience, you know, experience failures, overcome challenges, it builds that confidence and that comfort with yourself, which just makes things less stressful, I think, in general.
Yes.
But you are executive for Group Risk and Investment. And yes, you're. What does that mean?
So I'm looking after all the products that Liberty Corporate Benefits has to offer. So I look after the umbrella fund. We have about 50 billion rand in assets under management there. I look after the group risk piece, so all the standalone group risk and what feeds into the umbrella fund. I think we've got about 3 billion rand in API coming in there. And then the standalone investments as well for Liberty Corporate.
Yeah. Okay. And, you know, being a leader, has that always been something intentional that's shaped your career path, or has it just kind of happened coincidentally?
I think it has happened without me thinking about it. But if I do think about it, then it makes sense, because I am naturally a leader.
Okay.
So I think that's the correct path that I've been on. And maybe I haven't planned it as I would have in terms of the route, but I'm quite comfortable. Yeah.
Okay. What's the next book you think?
The next book, I can't say this. The next book is The Subtle Art of Not Giving a F. But I want to, and this ties into a lot of what we're saying. And like you said when we were chatting earlier, it's quite a popular book. I felt it was quite crude, but sometimes you need that hard, tough love and crude words to set you on the right track.
And the author is Mark Manson.
Mark Manson.
The Subtle Art of Not Giving a F.
So he says, because there's an infinite amount of things that we can now see or know, there's also an infinite number of ways that we can discover that we don't measure up, that we're not good enough, that things aren't as great as they could be. And this rips us apart inside. Because here's the thing that's wrong with all of the how to be happy that has been shared 8 million times on Facebook in the past few years. And here's what nobody realizes about all of this crap. So these are his words, not mine. The desire for a more positive experience is itself a negative experience. And paradoxically, the acceptance of one's negative experience is itself a positive experience. This is a total mind. So I'll give you a minute to unpretzel your brain and maybe read that again. Wanting positive experience is a negative experience. Accepting negative experience is a positive experience. And this is what is known as the backwards law. The idea that the more you pursue feeling better all the time, the less satisfied you become, as pursuing something only reinforces the fact that you lack it in the first place.
Oh my word.
Isn't that so insightful?
Flowing.
Mm-hmm.
Gosh. How is that, you know, can you think of some examples where that's manifested for you?
Gosh, there's so many. Let me think. So coming back to what we spoke about on social media, there's so much available. So that's what he's saying. There's so much available. Excuse me. So that we're looking at people's lives, but what people put on social media is only the shiny pieces. And so when we are looking at this, we're like, but I'm not thin enough. I'm not smart enough. I haven't progressed as far in my career as Jane Doe. And I think taking a step back and looking at, so what are these people sharing and why am I feeling so convicted to be comparing myself with them? And if I was, and that's coming up in one of the other quotes as well, if I was thinner or earned more money or drove a better car? Would I be happier or not? And I think that is each of us as individuals have to take a step back and think, do we really want to compare ourselves with everything that is on the internet? What is it that we want for ourselves? So if I take something as simple as training for a half marathon that I've done, it doesn't matter. I've realized that now because I'm quite slow in running. So I take a 3 to 3.5 hours to finish a
track. Sounds amazing to me.
But I mean, there are people that do it in, my husband would do it in less than 2 hours. And people would finish. And when I was training for Two Oceans the first time in 2019, I finished with 30 seconds to spare from the cutoff time. I think that's
the 20 seconds too fast thing.
Yeah, I spent 30 seconds too fast. The cutoff time is what created anxiety for me. And that pursuit of perfection of, or perfection for me, finishing with enough time to spare was something that was working on my mind for the longest time. But I finished. But what are people going to say? Like, I've only made it 30 seconds before the cutoff. And nobody cares, actually.
Mm.
The fact that I've completed a half marathon at that age, 30-something, after having two children, and managing a career and a family, etc., putting in the time to train, that was something in itself. So that, for me, was a mind opener. So it is, I'm now running for fun, which is so liberating. I'm not chasing a time. I'm not chasing finishing within a set amount and not getting cut off, etc. I'm running because look what my body can do. Look how far I can push it, and enjoying that time with my brain and my thoughts.
Do you listen to music while you run?
If I'm running on the treadmill, yes, I do listen to music. But if I'm running on the road, like in a race, then no.
So you're just alone with your thoughts?
Yeah,
for 3 hours.
Yes. Yeah, my thoughts are beautiful.
Okay. I respect or I admire that. It's so, you know, often with these conversations, it's so interesting how there's a theme that emerges in the books that people choose, and it's not always intentional. So I don't, you know, with you, obviously it's this theme of vulnerability, self-acceptance, not comparing ourselves to others, gratitude, finding joy in who we are and what we have has come through. Would you say that that's a conclusion or a lesson you've come to sort of on your own through life experience? Or do you think, and then the books have kind of backed that up, or have the books taught you that and you've applied it and built it into your life?
The former, because I want to be myself. I want to show up as myself.
Yeah.
The books have reinforced that I can.
And giving you the language to articulate it.
Absolutely. And that is so empowering. That is super empowering. And I love it.
Yeah. It's and this is also a theme that's come up, is that you have these thoughts and these feelings, and then someone's like written in a book, and it just makes you feel validated that this is a real thing.
Yes. Like, she's listening. They're listening to my thoughts, and they've written it for me as advice for me. I know.
And when you do read these leadership or, you know, self-help books, how do you, and I guess, you know, what we say is the knowledge is already there and the implementation is already there. But if there are things you learn and you think, oh, this is something I want to apply in my life, how do you actually go about doing that? Because I find these nonfiction books quite overwhelming, and I might think, oh, this is so good. But then the moment I put the book down, I've forgotten about it. Mm-hmm. So do you have any tips for that?
Yeah. And that's why I keep going back to the books as well. So I generally stay with a book for a number of months, even after I've read it. And I bring it into conversation a lot in the workplace, and even it with my kids or with at home or with the friends, etc., to say, you know, I was reading this book and there's a quote in it that's so applicable to our situation now, and keep bringing it in. So then that kind of reinforces it. Because to your point, we read the book, we think it's great, and then we get stuck in the rat race of life and work and everything else that comes with it. And it's so easy to forget we learned a good lesson, but we're not putting it into practice.
Yeah. And, you know, for example, this one about the negative experience of wanting something you don't have. If I don't immediately think of a concrete example of how to apply that, then it stays theoretical.
Yes.
So do you Then do you prefer physical books over, you know, audio, yes, Kindle, so you have them, yeah, to have?
I do prefer the physical books because I like to fold the pages.
Yeah.
But I think on the Kindle, you can also highlight. But it's not the same. I feel like a screen hurts my eyes, and it's with a book. I mean, I can lie in bed and read, but the screen is heavy, or maybe I'm just old-fashioned in my thinking also.
Well, I mean, I'm a big Kindle reader, but I think with nonfiction, and I'm seeing this now, you know, with the pages turned over, just being able to have them to hand and reference them when you need to, I think it probably does wonders for just reinforcing the ideas.
Mm.
Okay, let's first go to the next book, and then we'll talk more about your leadership.
Okay, cool. This is Nolita Fukuda. It's Boardroom Dancing. So it says transformation stories from a corporate activist. So this is nice in terms of representation to see how women are in the boardroom, women of color. And this is talking about a racial experience that she encountered when she was working for Woolworths and how she had support from her manager at the time. So she says, one day, a customer refused to talk to me, making it clear that a black manager was not acceptable. Mm-hmm. Seeing how put out she was, I offered to call our head office, something that was still occasionally done back then. We put her through to our head of retail operations at the time, who later became CEO, etc. And he said to her, ma'am, with the greatest respect, we'd really appreciate it if you would stop shopping at Woolworths. That person that you're talking to, that person that you're talking about is one of our staff members, and this is how things are. And she said, you know, the customer was very shocked, and so was she. And she says, while I had been struggling to believe that someone felt so strongly about me being black that she refused to let me assist her, now I was equally astonished to see that someone else who was white felt so strongly about my right to do my job that he was prepared to tell a customer we didn't need her business. She says, this was one of my first direct racial confrontations, and it opened my eyes to the fact that white people committed to treating people fairly and equally, regardless of race, also existed. I think that's quite powerful. It also demonstrated the power business leaders could wield when they clearly decided to change the status quo and were willing to say that certain behavior was no longer acceptable.
Gosh, what did that do for you when you first read it?
So I had an incident not directly comparable to what Nolita was facing, but support was directly comparable. So it was years ago. I had just started working, and there was a lady that had called, and she was speaking in Afrikaans. And I am not confident to speak in Afrikaans still after having lived in Namibia for 9 years, because I have an accent that people make fun of. So I'm like, no thanks.
Same.
So she spoke to me in Afrikaans, and I responded in English. Mm. She was not happy about that. And she said to me, do you people only speak in English there? And I said, well, I speak in English, and I can understand what you're saying, and you can understand what I'm saying. So I was so young as well, so I didn't understand what the problem was. But she had written in a complaint to my bosses that there was someone that refused to speak to her in Afrikaans. And I was so hurt, because I thought I was communicating clearly and what was the problem, etc. And my manager at the time, he read through the details of the complaint, and he had written an email to say, I have very little sympathy for this person because I don't see she could communicate. Melissa could understand her. Our business language is English. So what is the problem? And that similar support is what Simon gave to Nolita in Boardroom Dancing, is what I also had many, many years ago, almost 20 years ago. But that just shows that you can get support from your managers, and they can be a place where people are saying this type of behavior is not acceptable in the 2000s where we are living now.
I was going to ask, maybe we can answer both questions. So, you know, based on, I guess, lessons from Nolita and your own experience First of all, women interested in climbing the corporate ladder but don't know where to start, what would your advice be? But then also managers, male and female, who want to be that support, you know, what are some things that they can do to uplift, you know, I guess, women and other, you know, less represented groups in their careers?
I think with that one, we are very fortunate because we do have more representation. We don't have a lot. We do have more representation now than what we had in the past. So, and the representation that we have now, very pro women leaders. So you just have to pluck up the courage, pick someone that you think would be a good role model for you, that you think would have advice for you, and pluck up the courage to say, can I have a coffee with you? Can I have a chat with you? And then when they say yes, because they will say yes, make sure you have clear questions of what you want to ask them. You can't just say, so how do I climb up the ladder? I mean, you can ask them to tell you their story, sure. But we need to spend some time introspecting into ourselves to say, what are the areas that we think we need advice in? And what are the specific questions that we want to ask these individuals? What are the things we're struggling with, et cetera? Yeah, I think that will work well. Men in the environment that can uplift. I think there are, I can give you many examples of men in the environment that have either lifted me up, given me a chance, or supported me in my career growth. There are so many of them that are doing well. And we were just talking about in the actuarial profession, it's a white male dominated world. So if each one sponsored or looked after one woman, we can then double our actuarial profession numbers. But I think it's just making the time as well.
Yeah. That's such a profound thought. You don't need to save the world. You just need to mentor one person and help one person. So you were on as a council. Can you tell me what that experience was like and what are some of the things that you focused on during that time?
We were in COVID when I joined. So there was a lot of vaccine debate items happening there. We spent a lot of time discussing and debating that. We spent a lot of time on transformation of the profession, looking into why are Black students not passing as quickly as white students, and putting in interventions in there as well. I spent a lot of time, I was the chair of the member engagement board. So how are we communicating with our students to help them? If you're writing an exam 15 times and getting FAs and FCs and FDs, why is it that way? So a lot of time spent on the education piece and the member communication.
Did you come to any findings with respect to, you know, why Black students weren't passing as quickly as white counterparts?
Yeah, I think my colleagues at ESSA can probably add more color. But what we found is that the support structures for Black students are not as strong. The foundation is not as strong in terms of home-life balance. So a Black student, they're studying and working, will still have a lot of family commitments, will still have a lot of Black tax that they have to do. And those are the things that are on their mind. They are not able to completely focus on studying alone. They are not necessarily living on their own yet to have that space, to have that quiet time for studying, etc. They don't have access to the role models that the white students necessarily have, that generational wealth of networking either. So, and I'm not saying that those are the only reasons, but those are some of the reasons that we picked up where we thought, how do we intervene and how do we help? Social intervention is what we needed.
It's like you were saying earlier, it's psychosocial. Psychosocial.
Yes.
Okay. Like you were saying earlier, it's, you know, not only that the exams themselves are hard, but maybe that's not the worst part. It's all that anxiety around it, which, you know, yeah, when you're worrying about supporting your family and being the first person in your family to go to the university and, you know, having all these other commitments, not having the support.
Yes.
It's amazing that the people still do make it.
Yeah.
The question I wanted to ask earlier is, and this has to do with, you know, female leadership. Do you think there's an element of gatekeeping in our profession with women who have made it? I'm interested to get your thoughts on that. Do you think it's women holding other women back, or do you think generally women want to uplift?
Yeah, I definitely think women are wanting to uplift. I've never, in our profession or even in the insurance industry, I've not encountered a woman that has tried to hold me down. In fact, a lot of them have tried to make way and tried to help to grow. So I think we are standing together, which is great. We try to help each other out whenever we can. Maybe I can give you an example. When I was at Old Mutual, and I had just become a finance actuary and didn't have much background in life insurance valuations. It wasn't only women as well, but there was one woman in particular that would make time for me, sit down, draw pictures, be able to explain how the flow of money works, how the different channel works, etc. And you wouldn't think that you would find that in the workplace. Everyone is busy. Everyone wants to do their own thing, but they were very extremely helpful, extremely wanting to help you to understand, help you to be better. Oh, you have a presentation. Okay, so do you want to do a dry run? Like those things are all, they were really soul warming.
And I think that kind of action enables you to move to a role you haven't done before when you're more senior, because I think the perception is that if you are senior and going to a role, you're expected to add value straight away.
Yes.
And that might put you off from trying something new because, you know, no one has time to teach you. But
yes,
as you say, if someone's willing to take a bit of time, break things down to you for you, you know, understand that not everything is intuitive and it opens so many possibilities.
Yes. It also makes you braver to ask the questions and not feel like, you're asking a stupid question. How are you in this role? I've not felt like that yet.
Yeah, it's amazing. I'm constantly, you know, my heart's constantly warmed by the actual community and how generous everyone is. Something you touched on earlier and, you know, at the beginning of the conversation as well, when you spoke about COVID and vaccines and the work that's, or the trends you guys are seeing, mortality. If you can share, I'd be interested to know, you know, what do you think COVID has sort of a main impact on our best estimate mortality rates, or how has the pandemic kind of affected how we set mortality rates, for example?
Yeah. So I think a lot of us have removed COVID loadings from the rates, but what we have realized is how we're setting the rates may be not sustainable long term, because group risk business especially is a very commoditized business. So we're fighting for price. But how we've been setting price is to price the bare minimum margins in, so that when you do have a catastrophe like we had a few years ago, all, you know, decades of profits are wiped out because the profits are so tiny. So how we're setting the price, we've not changed how we're setting the price because the market is so competitive at the moment. But it raises the question of how should we be pricing in the future, knowing that, okay, this was a 1-in-100-year event. What if that happens sooner again? Because like bacteria or those little viruses are coming for us in different ways. So how do you set pricing for a sustainable industry? That's something that we're grappling with, certainly on the Liberty corporate side. Yeah.
And yeah, how does one start to address it if you know, you can't really outprice, you know, you can't make it up in price. Are there other avenues that you have to be more sustainable as a business?
Yeah, so I think retention of business is extremely important and somewhere that we're focusing at the moment. Price is one factor. I mean, your bread might be cheaper at a Checkers, but you still go buy bread at Woolworths. Why is it? So we're looking at how are we making our customers feel? What is the experience that we're giving our customers to build that loyalty? What are the other sticky items that we can add to our product as a whole for our offering from Standard Bank Group to the individual or to the corporate that will make them stick? So price is important. Absolutely, we can be competitive, but we don't want our customers to make decisions on price alone. We want them to know, how do we make you feel that builds that loyalty?
I guess that's where innovation comes in. Because, you know, the price thing, you know, when that's out the picture, you actually have to start getting creative.
Yes.
Okay, what's the next book we're going to talk about?
Okay, so this one is The Enneagram of Parenting. Oh, I don't know how to pronounce the surname of the author. It's Elizabeth Wegele.
I don't know.
So I don't have a quote from this book, but it talks about Enneagram for kids. And I'm not sure if you're familiar.
It's a personality test.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe if you can. Yeah, I don't know much about it.
So there's 9 Ennea types, and working with it with my coach also helps to understand my own personality. So I had a lot of insight on that.
And it's the only one my kids are.
So I thought my type was a 3, which is the achiever.
Okay.
You know, intelligent, you get things done, blah, blah, blah. But then I did the test, and the results were conveyed to me by a different coach. And she said, okay, you've come out as a 2, which is the considerate helper.
Okay.
And I was like, I'm not a 2. I am a 3.
I don't want to help anyone.
This. And she was like, how do you know that you're a 3? And I'm like, I read the definition. She says, well, the way that you answer the questions is you're a 2. And we had a 1.5-hour session where she spoke through the outcome of my Ennea test. And the more she talked about it, the more it was like someone was holding a mirror up to me. And I was like, oh, I am a 2. Why did I not want to be a 2? Because it sounds fluffy and weak, and I am not weak.
Sounds like not main character.
No, yes. But when she spoke about things, so it's I always want to help people. Yes, I always have a solution. So if you're coming to me with a problem, I always know already how to solve your solution 5 steps ahead. I have burnout because I accept too many tasks and I make myself obligated to too many things.
Can't say no.
I can't say no. And why can't I say no? Because I want to help everyone and I don't want anyone to be upset with me. And I overcommit myself. So then I don't make enough time to spend on myself. Then I get upset when I've done so much for you and you're not thankful to me. So I was like, oh, yes, that is me. But one of the strongest characteristics of the considerate helper is relationship building. And I know that that is my biggest strength. I'm able to connect with people on that level of building real connections before actually becoming a peer or a colleague or a manager or a leader. But that has helped me so much in the last 5 years, working on myself, understanding, why am I upset with you, Pam? I organized this whole lunch for us and you're just like, oh. Understanding that people are not going to be upset with me if I decline an invite. Understanding that I don't have to say yes to everything. Understanding that I can say, this is the season for me to be a volunteer at the church. Therefore, I cannot be a volunteer on ASA anymore, for example. Understanding that when I make time for myself, I'm not being selfish. It is part of my whole self-love, making sure that I'm mentally stable vibe. And so learning to say no, my type has taught me it's uncomfortable. It's still uncomfortable learning to say no, but I do say it because I'm protecting my peace. So because I've made so much progress with understanding my type, I thought, I was chatting to my coach and I was like, I wonder what type are my kids?
Mm.
And so she lent me this book. And so the kids, when I was asking, so originally I asked them questions because there are questions in the book and they would answer the way they thought I wanted them to answer. So then I said, no. Okay. And I had in my mind what Ennea types they are. So I printed out the questions and I said, you fill it in. And I just mixed the questions up and then they filled it in. And they both come out to be 3s, which is what I went
up
to.
Oh, wow.
But why this book is helpful is it helps you to understand your child as a 3. It helps me to understand, and both of my children are 3. So I understand that they are competitive, that they are hard on themselves, that they are diligent. And when I praise one, why the other one would say, I can also do that. Watch me doing this cartwheel. So that has helped me to understand them so much, and just when they are getting upset, why, trying to understand why are they getting upset and how to approach better.
So when you say this book is sort of part of your, you know, self-improvement in terms of a parenting.
Yes. How to be a better mom, to know when to be more patient with them, when to push, when to pull, when to give them time, when to smother them.
You've mentioned, you know, speaking of children and I guess maths, now we've just touched on, you passionate, or you have an interest in cultivating love of maths from a young age in children, and, you know, the way you raise your children reflects that. Can you talk a bit about that interest of yours?
Yes. I think a lot of the time when we say to people, but maths is fun. Okay. I mean, we think maths is fun. I think all actuaries think that maths is fun, right? I hope
so, because we have to compare it to stats.
Yes. But it's the same in every country. You don't have to learn a different language to understand maths. It works the same everywhere. And there's a constant source of debate in my house, because my husband says he doesn't like maths, but he can do it. And my son also says he doesn't like maths, but he can do it. But my daughter and I are like, what? We don't like this vibe. We can't deal with this negativity that you guys are emanating. But I think a lot of people are fearful of maths. The numbers scare them. In South Africa as well, because the level of math literacy is not where we need it to be. So if I can get more people to understand, maybe not as obsessively as I do, that maths is fun and maths is cool, just understanding basics of maths. If you have a budget, how do you set a budget? How do you work a budget? So what we do with our kids, and probably our viewers are probably going to think I'm such a harsh mom, but you can let us know in the comments.
You're going to get cancelled.
I'm going to get cancelled. That's okay.
But at least my kids will know how to have a budget. So for the last 4 years, I've been saying to my kids, here's an amount of money for your birthday party. How you spend it is up to you. If you want to keep everything and not do anything else with it, that's fine.
Oh, that's a nice option.
Yes. They never want to do that.
Yeah.
So here's your money. And so Luke, for example, has his birthday over like 3 days, and he has his friends sleep over, and then we do an activity or we go to the movies and whatever. That's all great. So I'm available to drive you around. I won't charge you for my petrol. But this is that when your money is done, there's nothing further that we can do. So then he gets very innovative, right? So he's like, so if we stay at home and have dinner here and I take burgers from the freezer, are you going to charge me for that? And I'm like, no, I won't charge you for that. But it helps them to understand that money is not infinite, because I feel like when they're spending my money, then they're balling. But when they have to spend from their own pocket or use their own bank cards, then they're very skint. So it helps them to understand money is not infinite. Everything costs money. And the price of things as well. So if you're going to the movies, it costs. If you're buying popcorn, it costs money. If you're buying Coke, it costs money. If you're going bowling, it costs money. So then that's how they've been planning their birthday parties. But I think that basic skill of learning how to budget is so important for South Africans, because if we knew how to budget, and that's not a perfect, in a perfect world. I mean, I know that we have many other commitments, etc. But we're living beyond our means at the moment. That's why we are so keen to tap into our two-pot savings. If we had learned this from grassroots level at primary school on how to budget and how to spend our money, if we have a small pot of money, I think we might be better off as adults as well. Because now you start learning, you start working after school, after university, and you're earning this money, and you don't know whether you can go out and eat every night, or you don't know how much you're going to pay for rent. And these are things
you don't see.
Yes.
And this, I feel like this is the thread that's run through all of these things, is again that looking at other people and what they have, and then feeling that you also need to have those things.
Yes.
And not necessarily thinking about the means you have to support that.
Absolutely.
So are there any ways, you know, of all the volunteering and things you're involved in, are you, you know, involved in any kind of maths literacy or you know, education drives, anything like that?
Unfortunately, I haven't had the time to do that. But what is the thing that Soshin and them are doing?
Not actuaries in the making, right?
It's not actuaries. It might be actuaries in the making. I'm very happy. So I can't volunteer my time, unfortunately, because my Enya type tells me what I am busy with at the moment. Yes. But I can do financial donations. So that's what I'm doing now. So I'm helping out. In our neighborhood, we support a school. So we're giving financial contributions to the school so that they can find volunteers and teachers to help with the school. And when actually is in the making, ask for contributions. I'm the first one in the queue.
So we have you to thank. Thank you. And it's sort of what Magda was saying as well. You may not have the time, but there are other ways you can contribute. You can outsource your support. So all these lessons coming through. Okay, so those cover the books. I'll read through the list, which was Dare to Lead by Brené Brown, Magda.
Yes, sorry, Magda. That's
Magda W, My Journey. The Subtle Art of Not Giving an F by Mark Manson, Boardroom Dancing by Nolita Fakude, and The Enneagram of Parenting by Elizabeth Bugele.
Mm.
I had to be very cruel and send you to a desert island with just one of these books. Which one would it be and why?
Ooh. Huh. To the desert island. I think the next one that we're going to talk about, The Gifts of Imperfection.
Okay, yeah, let's talk about that one.
Yeah.
I think this is one of my favorite books. It's also Brené Brown, but it's an old school classic. It came back in the day. It's called The Gifts of Imperfection. There's so many gems in this book. You also see many, many folded pages. But there's a piece that I wanted to read to you. And now that you mention it, there is a thread that goes through all the books, which it was not my intention, but we are coming there. And you guys will see why with this book as well. It says, when we can let go of what other people think and own our story, we gain access to our worthiness. The feeling that we are enough, just as we are, and that we are worthy of love and belonging. When we spend a lifetime trying to distance ourselves from the parts of our lives that don't fit in with who we think we are supposed to be, we stand outside of our story and hustle for our worthiness by constantly performing, perfecting, pleasing, and proving. So our sense of worthiness, that critically important piece that gives us access to love and belonging, lives inside of our own story. So the greatest challenge for all of us is believing that we are worthy now, right at this minute. Worthiness doesn't have prerequisites. So many of us have knowingly created or unknowingly allowed being handed down a long list of worthiness prerequisites. So I'll be worthy when I lose 20 pounds. I'll be worthy if I can get pregnant. Oh, please don't let me get pregnant here. I'll be worthy if I get or stay sober. I'll be worthy if everyone thinks I'm a good parent. I'll be worthy when I can make a living selling my art. I'll be worthy if I can hold my marriage together, when I make partner, if my parents finally approve, if he calls me back and asks me out. I'll be worthy when I can do it all and look like I'm not even trying. And she says, here's what's truly at the heart of wholeheartedness. Worthy now. Not if, not when. We are worthy of love and belonging now, right at this minute, as is. So if I leave you guys with anything, we are worthy now. We shouldn't be waiting for anything else.
I would like to leave it there, but then I'd also like to ask if, you know, this question of being worthy of love and belonging inherently depends on other people loving us and, you know, making us feel like we belong.
Mm.
How do we reconcile those things that, you know, feeling worthy within ourselves, but then also having to live in a community or society?
So Dr. Seuss is a very good author also. And he said, those who matter don't mind, and those who mind don't matter. So whose approval are we seeking? Are we seeking our inner circle? Because those are the ones that matter. And they don't mind at my silly jokes or how I am showing up with my imperfection. And those ones who mind, where are they in the grand scheme of things? I think in The Subtle Art as well, I think it's in The Subtle Art, they say, you're in the arena. You're the gladiator in the arena. you are playing and participating. And there's an audience or there's spectators. And spectators can heckle at you and say you suck and you can't fight or whatever. But I'm here.
Yeah, they are the ones fighting.
Yes. And at the end of the day, it is, so who are you going home to? Who are your close circle of supporters and people whose opinions should actually influence what you are doing? That also took me a very long time to get to. So if Joe Soap on the street sees me running and he's like, well, Melissa, why are you going so slowly? You're going to get cut.
You're adding like CB from Friends.
Yes.
I've heard that before.
You don't really matter in my story. You're a spectator. You're not adding value or taking value away from me. And the little voice in my head will be quietened by the people who actually love me and say loving words to me. And so those people are the ones that will make me feel worthy and of worthiness and love and belonging now. And if they are not making me feel worthy of love and belonging now, why are they in my inner circle? There was a quote that I think it was Mel Robbins, who's another author that's really cool, that said, if you're constantly having to make yourself feel small, or if you're constantly having to be the bigger person, maybe you should ask yourself, why am I surrounded by such small people? So maybe the message for our audience as well is to, let's take stock of who are our actual five people whose opinions we value and who have influence on whether we are worthy or not.
That is a brilliant thought to keep on holding on Desert Island, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Final reading-related question. What are you currently reading?
So I haven't started yet, but I received this book for my birthday. And I'm going to start reading it when Luke starts studying for exams. Because when Luke is studying for exams, I don't move. So I can have some reading time. It's called AI for Life. It's 100 plus ways to use artificial intelligence to make your life easier, more productive, and more fun. The author of the book is Celia Quillian. And I think this is cool because AI is so topical at the moment. And I'm playing around with Copilot a lot.
Okay.
So I'm hoping that this gives me good gems. It is also on the cover, it says plan
a travel itinerary.
Okay. And I'm planning our December holidays. So I think this will be quite useful.
Well, please, yeah, share with us, you know, all the tips that you pick up. Nice to have them all in one place.
Yes.
Okay, so maybe something to read for that December holiday. So I don't know if you'll have a chance before then, is a gift. Look in your chairs, everyone. So this is The Myth of Normal by Gabor Maté. I don't know if you've heard of him. So yeah, this is a gift to say thank you for being on the podcast.
Hey.
I haven't read this myself, but I follow Gabor a lot. He's a very famous doctor and therapist who has done a lot of work in addiction, but also very prominent in this world of talking about authenticity versus attachment and, you know, how we should love and care for the people around us. Mm-hmm. And funny enough, I thought that this would be a good book for you. And then I messaged Soch and I said, you know, what book do you think would be good for mom? He said the same one, even though he also hasn't read it.
Yay. Thank you, Soch.
Yeah. So yeah, I hope you enjoy it. And please do report back if you do get around to reading it. And I'm glad you haven't read it yet, because that's always the
always.
Before we go, any last thoughts or shameless plugs that you'd like to share with our listeners? And then also where people can get hold of you or follow your journey.
So I think if they've listened all the way to the end, homework is, so who are your circle of supporters? Are they making you feel like you are worthy now? Because you are worthy now. And if they are not, then let's have a chat. You can find me on LinkedIn. It's Melissa Ramsamy Agapetus. Send me a message. Ask me for a coffee. But have your questions ready.
Amazing. Thanks so much, Mel.
Thank you.